Hello and welcome to another exciting and jam-packed episode of Modern Day Philosophers. I'm your host, I'm Danny Lobel, and I hope you're doing well. I'm broadcasting live from Jerusalem. Well, technically it's pre-recorded, but I'm alive in Jerusalem, which is nothing to take for granted. It's beautiful here. It snowed. The whole city is covered in a blanket of white. That's what happens when it snows, you know what I mean? And, well, I'm going to tell you this. This is going to be one of those longer intros at the top for those people who are always saying, come on, get to it quicker. This is not your week, guys. I'm sorry. And for those people who are saying, come on, talk more about your life. You're in luck. Because that's what I'm going to do today. It's a good show. It's a great show, in fact. We have Phil Rosenthal on the show today, the creator of Everybody Loves Raymond and writer. And we talk a lot about it. And it's really one of my favorite shows of all time. I think that Phil Rosenthal, who I would maybe give the quote-unquote genius tag to in terms of comedy, for whatever that means. I don't know, maybe a better term is artist. Because I think Everybody Loves Raymond is one of those shows that, to me, is art. It's very much realist art. And I think he masters beautifully real-life moments and real conversations. One of the things I love about the show was how Phil was able to take just maybe two rooms to tell a whole story. It's interesting. If you look at the show, there's not a lot of going out. There's not a lot of outside characters coming in. It's the same players in real life situations just having conversations. It's brilliant in that way. Whereas another show like Seinfeld, which is also the holy grail of television, of comedy television, yeah, they're taking you all over the city, or they're switching, you know, they're in the diner, they're in the apartment, they're at Elaine's boyfriend, they're there and here and there. You don't really see that too much with Raymond, and it's because it's so strong in the dialogue, and it's so very real. So that's why I love the show, and that's why I was even a little bit nervous talking to Phil Rosenthal in this episode. And if you listen to the show, you know I don't get nervous too often in these, but I'll tell you, maybe you'll detect a little bit of nervousness when I talk to him, because I'm very, very impressed by his body of work. And also his movie, which we touched on a little bit, called Exporting Raymond, where he goes to Russia and brings Everybody Loves Raymond to adapt it to Russia. We talk a little bit about that too. So you'll hear all that. But first, more about me in Jerusalem. Well, the intellectual folks who I was telling you about are great, great people. I'm having such a blast with these guys. And we're learning a lot of fascinating stuff about Judaism. Actually, in the episode with Phil, he brings up a few questions about Judaism that bothered him, and I didn't really have answers for him, and I was actually interested in asking some of those questions and some other questions that have been raised by past guests on the show in my time here, but I haven't even had to ask them because they've all been covered. And I've gotten some very fascinating, well, I find them fascinating answers. Maybe other people wouldn't, but I found them to be some fantastic answers. And I thought about sharing some of them with you guys here on the show, but I'll tell you why I'm not going to. Because I think that would make this show a different kind of show. The way I see this show, it's Modern Day Philosophers. I'm presenting the philosophies of my guests by using the great philosophers' ideas to spark conversation and get into the ideas and minds of the comedians who I'm claiming are the modern day philosophers of today. It's not a debate show, and it's not a show where I'm trying to push a theological agenda. I have my own beliefs. I can share them, but I'm not here to prove them. And so if you do want answers to these questions, there are answers out there. Maybe they'll satisfy you and maybe they won't. And I find them pretty cool. But more than anything, I'm here to show you what Phil thinks. So that's why I'm not going to spend a lot of time here going over what I've learned. But I really find it very interesting and very satisfying information. Okay, so here's a quick word from our sponsor, Mr. Dan Schlissel and Stand Up Records, the very label that put out my album, Some Kind of Comedian, available on iTunes and Amazon. And I'm going to have him say a few words, and then I'm going to tell you some big news. So take a listen to this.
Imagine a world where no one ever went hungry. Where you didn't have to choose between clean air and clean water. And where bitter, drunken comedians didn't have to work in small, dark clubs to tell you how severely screwed up everything is. If that kind of world scares you the way it scares us, then we can help. We're StandUpRecords.com. We offer the finest in CDs, DVDs, and merchandise from the best stand-up comedians on Earth. So please give generously, and remember, together we can't save the world. Yeah, no, we can't. So you may as well just buy something funny. That's StandUpRecords.com.
That was Dan Schlissel, a man who I hope to one day have at my wedding. That's right. That's how I choose to lead into it. I proposed to Kylie last night, and she said yes. So there you have it, folks. Wish I had like a sound effect for like a give myself a round of applause. It was pretty special. It was snowing in Jerusalem. We took a walk to the Western Wall in the snow, and standing there in front of the Dome of the Rock and the Western Wall in this beautiful setting with snow falling down, I pulled out a ring that I brought along with me. That's right, I had a plan. And I proposed to Kylie, and we are going to get married. So how do you like that? Hopefully you do, because I like it. And we're set to get married in the summertime. So I'll keep you posted on that. I guess hopefully I won't have to keep you posted on it. Hopefully that's what's happening. So I got to go back to Los Angeles, pick up some kind of day job, and start saving up for a wedding now. So that's what comes next. I'm getting married, people. I'm doing it. Huh? If you listen to the show, you know I've had a lot of fears about it and a lot of hesitations, but I'm jumping in because I love the girl and I think it's going to be great. I know it's going to be great. How about that? I'm getting married. What else am I supposed to tell you? I'm engaged, damn it! You can make a donation to the show, by the way. Go to moderndayphilosophers.net. And if you donate $20 or more, I'll send you a thank you card. I'll personally write and send you a thank you card. How about that? I don't have any more Tweaked Audio earbuds to give out, but you can pick them up at tweakedaudio.com. Go to their website and put in promo code MDP. And you'll get 1/3 off plus free shipping and a lifetime guarantee or warranty. Still haven't figured that out. All right. Okay. So the interview you're about to hear was recorded a few months ago, back when I was right before I left to be the best man at Tony's wedding. And you remember from listening to the show, some of the stuff I had from back then. I had that asthma attack. And things were, I went through a little rough patch there. I also almost cut my finger off with a butcher's knife, so you'll hear me talk about that with Phil Rosenthal. Just don't think that it's a recent thing, because some people were so kind, and I really appreciate it, and they emailed me, and they're like, how are you doing with the asthma attack? But it was a few months ago, that bad asthma attack, and this was a few months ago, too, when I almost cut my finger off. It's healed pretty nicely, a little scar, but I'm okay. So we talk about me almost cutting my finger off. We talk about his great book that I read called You're Lucky, You're Funny, How Life Becomes a Sitcom. I highly recommend it. And, well, you know what? I'll let you listen for yourself and you'll hear what we talk about. Here he is, the one and only Mr. Phil Rosenthal, ladies and gentlemen, right after the intro song. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
We're rolling?
We're rolling.
Hello.
Could we do a quick mic check? Let me hear how loud you'll get.
I'm going to be this loud mostly.
What's the loudest you would ever get?
I would get this loud mostly.
All right.
If I'm being emphatic.
And what about the quietest? What's the quietest you'd ever get?
This will probably be as low as I go.
All right. Well, that's a good range.
I'm a professional range guy.
I don't want to do this whole interview without addressing this wrapped, bandaged finger.
What'd you do?
I cut myself with a butcher's knife yesterday.
Ow. Did you go to the hospital?
Yeah, I got 5 stitches.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I didn't even know. It was a brand new knife I got from Costco.
Yeah.
And I was just cleaning it, and I didn't even know that it had cut me. I just felt my hand was wet, and I
That's a sharp knife.
It was a very clean cut.
So you know this is a very good knife.
It's a fantastic. That's exactly what I said to
Kylie. I wonder what
Kylie.
The great philosophers would say about such a thing.
Well, I don't know. What would you say?
That sometimes the thing that we don't see coming, that we don't expect to hurt us, can hurt us deeply.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a good way to look at it, sure.
You have to... Here's the philosophy. Be careful. How's that?
Yeah.
How's that?
Be more careful.
Which philosopher says that? Who do you think... Maybe it's my philosophy.
Yeah.
Be careful. You know, I have a philosophy for anyone over 40. I really, now that I'm well over 40, I've developed this philosophy. You know what it is? It's boiled down to one piece of advice for anyone over 40. I hope everyone's listening.
Mm-hmm.
Don't fall down.
Really? That's funny that you say that. That's in my act. That's in my stand-up.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Because you fall down after 40, your life can be screwed, right?
I worked in a nursing home, and I talk about it on stage, and I said, you know, there were guys that fought Nazis, and they had mustard gas falling on them, bullets over their head. In the end, what got them? Falling.
Yes, they slipped in the shower.
I say they slippery hallway or anything, so, you know?
Whatever. You fall down,
you're done.
Game over.
It's funny. We share this philosophy. This is
more than a philosophy. It's a way of life.
Yeah.
Please, people listening, be careful. Don't fall down.
Don't fall down. It's amazing.
Yes.
Right? I say, you know, there were guys I saw who would war veterans, and they'd wake up in the morning, they'd look at the hallway, and they go, it's you or me, hallway.
We take these things for granted, that I'm going to get up from this chair now, and gravity will be my friend, and I'll walk over there and grab something and come back. And it's fraught with mines and terrible loose rugs, and anything can cause you to slip and fall, and then your quality of life is diminished.
I remember when we lived in Brooklyn, one day I wasn't feeling well. And when I start not feeling well, I start thinking everything's going, you know? That's just...
If you don't have your health.
Exactly. So I think it's ingrained into us, right?
Yes.
So I start looking around my apartment in Brooklyn. I'm looking... there's a bike. I had a bike hanging on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a sharp statue... object, something that had a sharp point on it.
An Emmy?
Not an Emmy.
Oh, those are sharp.
Yeah. Oh, yours are beautiful.
That's why I said it, so you'd notice.
Yeah. But actually, I remember you mentioning in your book that the Emmys were sharp. And
I was with one of our writers who won, was walking into the after party. And he was holding it down at his side, and with the points facing forward, and jabbed a famous actress in the leg. Drew blood.
Really?
Yeah.
Drew blood.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm not kidding. You put those on a high shelf, and you don't let the children play with them.
He really wanted people to notice the Emmy, huh?
Well, I guess so. Hey, look what I got.
How'd you get that wound? Oh, I was stabbed by an Emmy. Who's Emmy?
That's right.
But so I was looking around the whole apartment. Yes. I was thinking, all these things could kill me. They all seem like good. Like again, when I got that knife cut yesterday, I was thinking, when I bought the knife, I wasn't thinking I'd be cut with it. But this knife... This is a dangerous thing. Everything you own could kill you, pretty much.
Be careful.
Yeah.
Hence the philosophy. Today's philosophy.
Be careful.
That's it.
So I'm very, very happy to be here. I'm very honored that you took the time
Glad
to spend
to
with
have
me.
You.
I enjoyed your book.
Well, I'm very lucky, you know, so I wanted to pay it forward, and that was my way of doing it, to make it... There's no secrets in how we did what we did, and I wanted to impart what I learned, really. Through trial and error to people, so they didn't have to go through so many trials and so many errors.
Right. Do you think it will work? Do you think people will have a smoother ride?
I
think you just find new trials and new errors now.
True. Well, the business has changed, certainly. But but the more things change, the more they stay the same, too. So as long as your values are correct and you, the basic philosophy, and I know we're cutting to the chase here, but... Why not give the premise? It's not just be careful today. But I always say the best advice I ever got was do the show you want to do, because in the end, they're going to cancel you anyway.
Right.
Right? So this is really my philosophy of life that I learned from this particular line was passed on to me through my dear friend Alan Kirshenbaum, who got it from one of the great show creators and executive producer, showrunners, Ed Weinberger. He co-created the famous Cosby Show of the 80s, yeah? And he co-created, Taxi, and he was an executive producer of Mayor Tyler Moore.
Okay.
So he has quite a resume. And this philosophy of do the show you want to do because in the end they're going to cancel you anyway, mm-hmm. really applies to every aspect of your life. Because we all get canceled one day.
Hmm.
So, do I want to live somebody else's idea of a life for me or my life?
Yeah.
Right? It's pretty good philosophy, don't you think?
Yeah, that's true.
So tonight we're studying Ed Weinberger, the great philosopher.
I like the line in your book where you talked about when the executives asked you what the show was, and you said, well, it's a traditional sitcom, and mm-hmm. they said, well, we're looking all those words, lose all those words, right?
Traditional, well-made, old-fashioned, well-made classic.
And then you
all said, words we should be avoiding.
They said hip. What did they say?
I said, what word should we be heading for? And he said hip and edgy.
Right.
And I said, well, you got the right guy because I'm Mr. Hip and Edgy.
It reminded me of, I think there's a story with Mel Brooks that with Blazing Saddles where they gave him a whole ton of notes and then he said, okay, thank you. And then he just threw him away. Have you heard that?
Well, there you go. Do the show you want to do.
Right.
Right? So yeah. It doesn't mean you don't listen. I consider every note very carefully. But then I do the show I want to do because only I know what I want to say. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you care that what you want to say gets out there, you have to do it your way. It doesn't mean you don't consider everyone else's point of view. Mm-hmm. And hell, you may even learn something from a note. It happens. Plus, by the way, a note from, let's say, a studio executive can be very valuable because they're usually the first people to see your work before the public does.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes the note comes because the thing you're trying to get across wasn't clear. And it may be just as simple as, hey, make that clearer.
Did you find that a lot with
Always.
Raymond?
Yeah. Always, sure. Things that we take for granted that we assume people know and understand, this happens in everyday life too,
mm-hmm.
where you talk to your wife and you, why doesn't she know that what I'm thinking?
Right, just right? not communicating
exactly,
it clearly.
Exactly. So the thing that she's reacting to maybe isn't a fault or anything other mm-hmm. than it wasn't clear. So this happens in sitcoms, it happens in movies too.
It causes wars.
Of course, the communication.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
happened in the Cold War, that the translation from the Russians, you know, before the missile crisis or during the missile crisis, that it wasn't clear mm-hmm. what they were saying and it was misinterpreted. Could have been the end of the world.
Now, the distinction there is you're saying, well, the joke might be funny, but you're not getting the point across to get the comedy across. Were there other times when the studios would say, we just don't like the joke? We
sure.
get it.
Oh,
we get it, but we don't like it.
Of course. And that happens too.
What do you do in that situation if you know that it's a good joke?
You pick your battles, you know? Sometimes if the joke doesn't mean that much to you, fine. The jokes a lot of the time are interchangeable, mm-hmm. right? But if the premise of the show or the message of the show that you're trying to get across, if there's a fundamental, well, you shouldn't be doing that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we got notes like Ray should help out more around the house or women won't like him.
Was that from a female executive?
That was from a female executive.
Yeah, I would figure so.
Women won't like him, she said, and I said, well, then why did they marry him?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that's every guy. Who yeah. helps out around the house?
Yeah.
Right? So I left it exactly as it was because I felt like you may not like him, but you know him.
That might be personal from her own life. She's just saying...
Of course. By the way, every note is personal from somebody's life. Everybody brings their own baggage to everything that they say,
mm-hmm.
everything that they think and do.
So you're playing psychologist at some point,
sometimes,
too.
But a lot of notes and feedback is, of course, subjective. That's why there's so many opinions. If it wasn't subjective, everybody would have the same opinion.
Right.
Right?
How difficult is it when you're the head of a show like that?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a lot of a power struggle just to be the top guy?
There is, in terms of taking these notes from studios and networks.
Mm-hmm.
You do have to, if not fight may not be the right word, but you have to stand up for what you believe and yes, fight for it. Yes. Nothing is easy. That's just mm-hmm. how it is. So there's always going to be opposition to the idea that you think is the best idea you ever had. Right?
What have you found has been the most effective way of dealing with people in this
always
situations?
Be nice. Always be nice. You gain nothing by being jerky. Right? Because at the very end of the day, people can take that away. We can agree to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. Now, some people on the other side may be jerky, and you may be very willing to go there and be just as jerky, if not jerkier.
Right.
I can out-jerk you.
Right, right. Because you don't want to be walked all over.
But you have to stay, and I can't say that I'm always successful at this.
Mm-hmm.
But be nice. Be nice to the people above you. But more importantly, be nice to the people who work for you. I worked at places where the boss wasn't so nice. So when I finally got a show of my own, I asked myself, how are you going to be? How are you going to run this show? What is the tone you want to set?
Mm-hmm.
And it came to me instantly. What if it was nice? What if the place that we worked in was nice? And by nice, I meant a pleasant demeanor, good hours, kindness to people, helpful, good food.
Mm-hmm.
Was essential to me. I think it's a great way of showing the people around you that you care for them by having food that's not just crap,
right?
But good and fun and you mm-hmm. know healthy and sometimes not, but always a good time.
Mm-hmm.
We bond together over food. We share our meals together, social times over food, and of course. You know the expression, the army travels on its stomach, right?
Yeah.
So that was key to me and a great way to show love and affection to the people that I cared about very much.
Very appropriate for the show where food was being shown with love all the time.
Food is love, you know, good
I mean,
food.
That was Marie, right? That was
absolutely.
The whole thing was food is
absolutely.
Love.
Absolutely. That was the hold she had on the whole family.
Yeah.
Was her power of cooking.
Yeah.
So we use it, in a way, we use it as a weapon, too. But it is a powerful motivator.
Uh-huh. How much do you think the family on screen
mm-hmm.
resembled the family behind the scenes?
I think it mirrored our lives, our real lives that we were living. I can't say physically that everybody was exactly that,
sure,
the way
sure.
they were
well,
in real
yet.
Life.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the it's no secret the parents were somewhat based on my parents and certain behaviors in Ray's family and Ray, of course, and me, of course, and my wife and Ray's wife. These were integral, even the kids.
Mm-hmm.
The things we had them do came from our kids were kind of the same age as those kids were growing up.
Was it tough to preserve because your life changed so much throughout the show becoming mm-hmm. successful? Was mm-hmm. it tough to sort of preserve that that life that you were trying to show?
No, because no matter what kind of outward success we had, we still had wives, parents, and children,
mm-hmm.
and siblings. And so that doesn't change with monetary success. That right. stays, I think, the same. Sometimes it can complicate things, but money issues were they're kind of boring to talk about, I think, in TV shows. Who cares?
Right.
We get at the heart of what's relatable to all of us, you know, the basic human
right.
values and relatable topics.
That's kind of what I loved about that show also. First of all, that every episode is evergreen in every way, you know.
Thanks. There was an effort made to keep it not topical.
Right.
Right?
So
it's very easy to make a joke about a current figure of the day, you know, a Kardashian joke. Well, tomorrow that'll be dated.
Right.
And we wanted the show to have lasting value, so we didn't do those jokes.
And everything seemed to have been stripped away right to the core of the family.
Well, that was a conscious choice from the very beginning. I thought, well, I'm doing the show for CBS, but in the back of my mind, why not make it for Nick at Night? Why not make it so that it lasts? Because look, I'm lucky enough to get a television show. Do I want it to be the thing of the moment, or do I want it to last? And I think, you know, it was so personal, the show, and it was so about our lives that we wanted it to be good. And if good means that it could last. Mm-hmm. We all want to make our mark somehow, right? So here's your opportunity.
Right.
CBS has given you a television show. Do we want it to last one season or forever?
So a lot of the parents are your parents, right? I've heard you've
a lot
talk
of the
about
behavior.
Right.
Yes.
And I remember the fruit basket story, the one you talked in your book about wanting to tell on Oprah, which also had a very nice message in it, that story, just because I think your words were, the work is the reward.
Well, the work is its own reward, yes. And to look for more beyond that is foolish. Yes, we'd like to get paid, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, looking for fame and fortune is a fool's errand. And just doing, if you put your head down and concentrate on the work, you'll find how gratifying that is. The other stuff is, you know, stardust. It's gone the minute it touches you.
You were talking about how you were upset that, the way I saw it, was celebrity triumphed art. Here you are as an artist, and you're being ignored because you're not a celebrity and an artist, right?
To be clear, they had, we were wrapping up the show after 9 years. Oprah was going to do a special episode dedicated to Everybody Loves Raymond going off the air. And the whole cast and I were invited, and then I was disinvited 2 weeks later. Why am I not invited anymore? Oh, she just wants the cast. And so I was okay with it, but everyone else, all my writer friends, said, what are you, stupid? Why would you okay that? You created the show, you should be on the show. And I started to think, that's right, I should be on the show. And I started to tell people, my people and my agent, that, you know, that it's not nice to disinvite somebody. Just, well, they don't have TV people on there. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we'll call them. Okay, they said, they called back and they said, we'll let you sit in the front row, but not on stage. No, not good enough. So I said, I'm not going. I'm not going to sit there like Uncle Shits His Pants while Doris Roberts say how they make the show. I make the show. They're the actors in the show. And so the more that this was going on, the more angry I was getting that I wouldn't, that I was going to be, cast aside in a way. And I thought it was quite disrespectful. And they invited me. I would never have dreamed in a million years that I was going to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and I didn't care about it until they disinvited me. Then it bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I think there was a personal connection to her where somebody said, you want to be on? I get you on. What do you mean? I know Oprah very well. I get you on. And sure enough, I was on. In the last 30 seconds of the broadcast, they brought me on. By the way, all backstage, I'm thinking, look at the show is going by. They brought me to Chicago to hose me, and I'm not going to be on. After all this, I'm not going to be on. But they brought me on for the last. I got a nice round of applause from the audience. They liked seeing the creator of the show that they like. And I started to tell my funny Fruit of the Month Club story. I thought, this is going well. And Doris Roberts suddenly jumped up and did the punchline. She thought she was helping and jumping in.
She stole your punchline.
She did, but she didn't mean to. She was just participating in the conversation, which is fine, except for the fact that now the show is over and I'm done. And that's the moment that hit me. You idiot. Did you get what you wanted?
Mm-hmm.
It was so important for you to be on the show. Here. Did you enjoy that? That idiotic moment of your life? What does that mean to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show? Very little, it turns out.
Was there a feeling back then that you, here you are, you've created this beautiful thing that everybody loves, but nobody was giving you, nobody knew who you were?
Please understand, I have been rewarded over and over and over for creating that show. My life is very, very good. And I'm not just talking about financially, I'm talking about every way possible. The goodwill that I get from people, the friends I made, that in and of itself. And here's the big secret, I would have done it for free. Because I loved it. I loved those people.
I loved
the job. The work was its own reward. I mean it. I got more than enough praise. I got everything and more. And yet, in this moment that I felt I was being disrespected by the Oprah Winfrey Show, not even by her, but probably her producers, who don't care about writers because they don't think their audience cares about writers. And by the way, they probably don't. Who cares is my point. Who cares? I have everything else. But the way the human mind works is, I don't have that. Why do they get that? And I don't get that. So I realized in that moment that I'm an idiot and that this is not worth caring about.
Were you able to transfer that over? Or
yes. I now don't worry about being on the Oprah Winfrey Show. Now I'm on your show.
Yeah.
Much better.
So when you're going back to the story with the fruit basket, basically you're writing for your parents in their voices when you're writing the show. So did you get a deeper understanding of your parents through writing the show?
Yes. I got a deeper understanding of myself writing the show. You know, because if I'm a man and Ray represents me, he can't always be right. In fact, most of the time, he's wrong. And so you have to be able to, if you're going to make fun of Deborah or the parents, well, what's their point of view? You have to understand that in order to write it. And once you do understand it, you understand how you're coming off to everyone else. Mm-hmm. So there's that. That was invaluable.
Is that a challenge? Because as you start seeing everyone else's perspectives, you know now how not to be wrong.
Yes.
And then you need to write things deliberately wrong.
Well, I can't help being wrong. It's just natural.
I'm still
who I am. It doesn't mean I'm going to change.
Right.
Okay. I'm still me. I'm still not helping out around the house.
Right.
But I understand why they're angry.
So you maintained your values, whether they were right or wrong. You said, okay, I don't...
Not my values, but my character.
Your character, yeah.
I mean, I can have the values. I can have these lofty values of being saintly and good, but I'm not going to be because I'm human.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the fact that your parents are both Holocaust survivors. How did that shape your perspective?
Well, obviously, the house is always full of laughs. The truth is that it was really that we alternated our household from great laughter to great drama, and I didn't know any other way. I do know that it would be used at opportune times for them, like if I asked for a bike. Mm-hmm. For my 10th birthday, like all the other kids had these cool bikes. Why can't I have a bike? I was told, you know what I got when I was 10?
Right.
Yeah.
You can't compete with the camps.
No, you can't. So that, and a kid, you know, a 10-year-old kid doesn't care about the Holocaust. He wants his bike. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to know that history. First of all, it's friggin' horrifying, and if you were lucky enough to go to Hebrew school, it was really, at least at mine in New York, was taught, I thought, at a crazily young age. Your childhood is kind of taken away once you know about such things. I would prefer that my kids didn't know that this happened until they were older, and sadly, you do have to know that evil exists in the world, and that monumental evil even exists in the world. Evil that you can't even comprehend.
Do you still think about the Holocaust much?
No. No, who wants to think about it?
I don't know.
I mean, it's not that it's not worth thinking about. Obviously, I have thought about it. It's just like, there are people who it consumes them almost on a daily basis, but I don't think it's healthy to live your life that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm not saying forget. It's very dangerous to forget that this exists and that this type of evil can occur at any moment. We're seeing it now.
Right.
I think you learn from history and then you move on and try to make it better. But to dwell on it in a morbid kind of, look what they did to us, which is, you know, there's a part of my family, distant family, that lives their life this way. Mm-hmm. I don't understand it. I don't get it. I don't want to be part of it. Life really is, if you're lucky enough, it's too good to harp on the bad.
Why do you think the Jews are constantly being persecuted throughout history?
This is a very good question. I doubt that I'm equipped to answer.
I don't think you'll have the definitive answer, but no. I wonder in your perception of things.
Well, why? We're a small, physically weaker population, I think. So, and they're bullies in the world. How mm-hmm. about that as a reason? I don't know why else. But I'm proud of my cultural heritage. I can't say I'm a religious person, but I'm proud of where I come from and the culture and the values of the people I come from. The values, I think, are important.
Were your parents religious?
Not so much. I would say they were conservative. They sent me to a conservative Hebrew school, which was way too strict for me. My kids went to a Reform school. But I think I'm a practicing atheist at this point in my life. I think my parents would even say that, maybe not out loud, but they don't go to synagogue very much. I just think that a lot of the stories and a lot of religion in general, it seems like mankind is moving past it, or should be moving past it. We take what's good about these stories and apply the values of those stories to everyday life, but it doesn't mean we have to believe in a mystical being mm-hmm. in order for those stories to have relevance in our lives. This is my own opinion. I'm not preaching this in any way. This
sure.
is just what works for me now. I think I can be a decent human being without that extra belief.
Do you think it detracts from life's experience being religious?
Depends on the person. There are people, I would never argue with somebody who has a real belief and a deep commitment. I actually think those people are blessed and lucky to have that belief. I happen to not have it.
Your parents sending you to a Hebrew school after surviving the Holocaust must mean that their faith wasn't completely shook from it, right?
I think if you survive something like that, you hang on to that faith. And part of you believes that maybe that faith helped get you through. Or it shakes your faith, but you believe in the cultural history and keeping that culture alive. That's different from religious belief, right? Hey, they tried to kill us all. We're going to keep our culture alive through these rituals and things that we do. The Seder, the lighting of the candles.
Why is that important?
It ties you to the past. It ties you to your, literally to your loved ones who came before you. So I think that's why ritual exists. It ties you to where you came from. It teaches your children who you are and something that they can then present forward. Mankind's life on earth has always been filled with rituals of one kind or another. Whether they believed in one god or 30 gods or any gods at all, our daily life is filled with rituals, whether we believe anything or not. Mm-hmm. You know, even brushing your teeth is a ritual. And it's a way we do it. And if you saw your dad do it that way, maybe that's how you brush your teeth, you know, to connect to him in some way. Or because he taught you that way. He taught you how to put on a tie. So I put on my tie the way my dad taught me how to put on my tie. That's as powerful to me as any religious ritual that I saw him do or not do.
Were you an atheist as a kid?
I believe I was. I just didn't know that's what it was called. But I would hear Bible stories and I would wonder, and the prayers. Now, this is very, I mean, I don't want to offend anybody listening, but I thought the way that the character of God was presented in what I was hearing was vengeful and mean and demanding in such a way that wasn't keeping in with the idea that he loves us. If he loved us, he wouldn't demand that we put him before all others and that we say his name over and over and we bow down to him and we do. Sounds like a dictator, like a king. Yeah, I mean, this is the little kid in me feeling this. Mm-hmm. And so it just felt weird to me. This is not, I'm not saying anything against God or the idea of God. It's the way God was being presented in my particular education.
Do you think had God been presented differently to you that you might believe in God? Yeah?
Yep, I do. Because I would have wanted to believe. I did not want to believe. It's a conscious choice. I did not want to believe in a God that would be so vengeful and cruel as depicted in the Bible. Mm-hmm. That was being presented to me.
Maybe you could have gave some notes. some executive notes. Maybe if he helps around the house a little more.
I mean, what if we want to get into it, for the very first Bible story I ever heard, and I had a little book of Bible stories, Abraham is woken in the middle of the night to sacrifice his son. Who's doing this terrible practical joke?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty rotten. Why? If he's God, he really needs this show of devotion from his best guy, right?
You want to know how I heard that one explained?
Yeah, please.
That Abraham understood too much about God.
Okay.
He understood too much about how everything worked, and he understood, and if you understand completely everything about God, then there's no faith left. Mm-hmm. So there was no faith left to challenge him, and God knew that Abraham knew all the things that God would or wouldn't expect from him. Mm-hmm. So in order to test Abraham's faith, he had to give him something completely irrational that wouldn't be in keeping with him, which is why he did that. That's how I learned it.
Does that make it okay?
Well, it would make it the only way to challenge him, I guess. I mean, he doesn't wind up killing his son. I don't know. I mean,
first of all, how's their relationship after that?
It could be a bit awkward.
Go explain that to your boy.
Yeah.
Just kidding, son.
Yeah, yeah.
God was testing me. Really? I think I'm going to sleep over here now. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And this Talmudic interpretation that you just gave, if God was a person, it would sound like a bully's excuse. Right? The character of God as presented in this story. These stories were written by people.
They're allegorical, you know.
They're allegorical.
They're not supposed to be taken literally. But
they wanted to say something about the character of God. So they wrote this story, right? Mm-hmm. They wanted to scare you. They wanted to show that just how strong your devotion should be, that you should want to kill your son, that you should do it because God said to, that you should do it. Now, don't worry, God's a good guy. He's not going to make you go through with it. But you should be ready to do it if we say so. I didn't like that. I don't want any part of it. just from that story. And there's many, many, many more stories. This is just my brain and how it works. I'm not espousing this as a philosophy that you should all, and by the way, your reasoning not only probably works for you, but for many, many, many other people. And I'm fine with it. That's great. I'm glad you get comfort from that story. I'm glad that I don't.
Yeah.
I get comfort from other things, right? You like vanilla and I like chocolate. That's fine. Live and be well.
Right. I agree. I'm not of the opinion that anyone should be one way either.
Why not?
Yeah.
Just, you know what? Every religion, if we all stuck to the one basic tenet of all religion, do unto others. This has nothing to do with God, does it? God's name is not mentioned in do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If we all of us, Muslims, Arabs, Jews, everyone, stuck to that, wouldn't the world be a tiny bit better? I'd say a lot better.
Yeah, it stands to reason, I would think so. Sure.
So what is all the extra stuff on top of that? All the extra religion on top of that? What does that get you if you're going to ignore the basic tenet?
Well, you're working off the premise that people are just ignoring it. There are those who don't, you know?
Of course.
Basically, every system can be perverted, so...
Yes, and we're seeing a lot of it.
We see a lot of it, sure.
Yeah.
Would it mean that if the system wasn't there, there wouldn't be a new system that they would pervert?
I think you're right. I think that anything can be bastardized to the point where it ignores the basic tenets of its own existence, right?
Right.
They're wonderful religious people. I would never say otherwise. I'm saying that we're seeing now the problems in the world grow out of this fanatical side that's ignoring the basic tenets of its own religion.
Right. It's ironic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On every side, by the way. On every side.
So I don't think it's religion to blame.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fanatical behavior. I think it's the people who have agendas.
And who are using the religion.
They'll use that or they'll use... nationality,
yeah,
or they'll use,
yeah,
you know, just whatever they can get people riled up behind.
Yeah.
So.
Hey, listen, let's agree that whatever works.
Yeah.
Right? Works.
Yeah, yeah.
That if religion makes you a better person, I'm all for it. A better person is someone who lives and lets live.
A Paul McCartney guy. The other me. You remember that song? The other me would rather be the glad one. That was a better man.
Very nice.
The other me would never let you down. Uh-huh. I want to be the kind of me that doesn't let you down as a rule. That's a Paul McCartney, the better man.
He's already pretty good.
Yeah. All right, should we take a look at this philosopher?
Please.
So I became aware of you as more than a name on the screen when I saw Exporting Raymond, and I loved it.
Thank you.
So I asked Alex, I said, let's do something. Let's do something that can maybe spark some stories from that.
Wow.
And do a Russian philosopher.
Oh, boy.
So the guy we're going to talk about is Prince, and I'm going to try and say the name, but it's in a Russian name, Pyotr, which may be Peter. I don't
know.
Yeah,
Peter is good.
Alexievich.
Yeah.
Kropotkin.
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 Okay, never heard of him.
Kropotkin. Kropotkin.
Kropotkin.
Kropotkin?
Oh, that's much different. I never heard of him either.
Well, he lived from December 9th, 1842, to February 8th, 1921.
Nice long life.
He was a Russian geographer, economist, activist, a philologist, a zoologist, an evolutionary theorist, a philosopher, a writer, and a prominent anarchist. Kropotkin, he advocated a communist society free from central government and based on voluntary associations between workers. He wrote many books, pamphlets, and articles, the most prominent being The Conquest of Bread and Fields, Factories, and Workshops, and his principal scientific
offering. He sounds like the life of the party already. You better read fast, because I started to fall asleep about three sentences ago.
Okay. Maybe I could read in a more compelling voice.
I don't think it's your voice. I think it's the subject matter, but go ahead.
Mutual aid, a factor of evolution. How about that? Like more of a planetarium guy.
No, you better just...
He also contributed to the article on anarchism to the Encyclopedia Britannica 11th edition. I don't know if he knew he was doing that. He was born in Moscow into the second highest level. He was born in Moscow. Is it? I can't win with this material.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm being disrespectful.
He was born in Moscow into the second highest level of Russian aristocracy. His mother was the daughter of a Cossack general. His father was a prince in Samolzik. Does that sound like a place you've heard of? No. Of the Rurik dynasty, which had ruled Russia before the rise of the Romanovs. Anyway.
What's his philosophy?
Now I got the philosophy. I just wanted to give you a little background on it. But I don't think it was it wasn't a hit.
I think the philosophy has to be better than the background.
But I always feel like the background shapes the philosophy.
Of course.
So you got to have
so
some...
So he had a boring life, and here's his philosophy.
Were you in Moscow?
I was.
That was in Moscow, yeah. The movie, if I remember.
Yeah.
How long were you there for in total?
It's about 2 months.
Did you pick up any of the culture while you were there?
Sure,
personally?
Can't help it. It gets all over you.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Have you gone back since you've
done it?
I
haven't. I would like to.
All right. Well, I'll give you... In the
non-winter months.
I'll give you a synopsis of his philosophy here. He believed his anarchism, no government, was the only way for a society to be just. Laws only enforce a beneficial way to act, and these are fully possible without the laws in place. This is kind of our religion conversation.
Good luck to him, by the way, trying to get that across.
When we allow laws to be made, the government can now throw people in jail, thus making laws a slippery slope to abuse power. Without government, harmony will be reached by the mutual agreement against danger, as opposed to fear of authority. I think this is kind of what we were just talking about with whether or not religion is important in keeping people. But now we're talking about government, but religion can be a way of governing people.
It can be, and it has been used that way in the past. And in fact, our own government, if you trace it back, stems from religious laws, right?
Mm-hmm. So on top of this, people then forget about their ability to act properly and assume the law is synonymous with virtue.
Where has this philosophy worked ever? Where has the anarchist's idea ever worked? Not everybody's great and nice, and their laws need to be for the people who aren't so nice, mm-hmm. right? That's right. Why we have them, because they're people who go around and shoot other people, and what happens to them if there's no laws?
I guess
he didn't talk about any downside to anarchy.
I think what he's saying, though, is people at a certain point, they just won't want to live in danger, and they'll work it all out when the smoke settles.
No, I think there'll always be people who take advantage of the weak and are bullies and then they're going to rise to power and stamp out the anarchists and make their own laws so that they can...
So it can never work.
Yes, I like the idea of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not saying in practice it's always good, but I like the idea of it. I think anarchy, that's a crazy talk.
I think anarchy, doesn't it kind of mean crazy? To be...
We'd have to get a dictionary, but...
I'll give you a paragraph of his.
You know, I just think that you envision people running crazily through the streets.
Yeah.
When you hear anarchy.
Sounds a little fun, doesn't it?
It does. It sounds great for a college party, mm-hmm. but that's probably where it should stop.
College parties, people tend to be harmonious.
Yeah, try to get a road or bridge built.
Yeah. All right, well, here's a paragraph of his stuff I'll ask you to read, and feel free to break throughout it at any point to discuss it.
You want me to read it out loud?
Yes.
All right, here we go.
And it
this is Phil Rosenthal reading a paragraph.
Of Peter
Kropotkin. Here's your paragraph. Anarchism, the name given to a principal theory of life and conduct under which society is conceived without government, Harmony in such a society being obtained not by submission to law or by obedience to any authority, but by free agreements concluded between the various groups, territorial and professional, freely constituted for the sake of production and consumption, as also for the satisfaction of the infinite variety of needs and aspirations of a civilized being. He's assuming a lot. He's assuming that everybody loves each other and is going to work together and there'll never be any problems. I wish I had this guy's point of view.
Yeah,
on
a lot
life.
Of faith in humanity.
A lot
there.
Of faith in humanity. Well, I'm the wrong guy to give this to, but it's okay. If we want to talk ideally, let's have an open mind. In a society developed on these lines, the voluntary associations, which already now begin to cover all the fields of human activity, would take a still greater extension so as to substitute themselves for the state in all its functions. They would represent an interwoven network composed of an infinite variety of groups and federations of all sizes and degrees, local, regional, national, and international, temporary or more or less permanent, for all possible purposes: production, consumption and exchange, communication, sanitary arrangements, education, mutual protection, defense of the territory, and so on. And on the other side, for the satisfaction of an ever-increasing number of scientific, artistic, literary, and sociable needs. Moreover, such a society would represent nothing immutable. On the contrary, as is seen in organic life at large, harmony, it is contended, results from an ever-changing adjustment and readjustment of equilibrium between the multitudes of forces and influences, and this adjustment would be the easier to obtain as none of the forces would enjoy a special protection from the state. There is a reason you've never heard of this guy.
You don't think it's just hasn't come over from Russia? But he is saying what I was saying, that all the craziness would happen and sort of the dust would fall, and in his opinion, things would fall into place, but nobody would, without the protection of the state. That's what he's saying. Nobody.
Do you know
would
how many dead people there would be?
He's saying, let it all happen, and then maybe what we'll be left with is just a bunch of people that are willing to work together without.
Why do I think this was written in a shack in the middle of the woods with no other people around?
I think that's where all the great writing in Russia has ever been done.
I'm imagining a shack in Siberia with a bottle of vodka as his only friend. In his bio here, he was born in Moscow into the second highest level of the Russian aristocracy. So this was a rich kid who lived an anarchic life anyway. He had probably no boundaries whatsoever and did whatever he wanted. And so everybody should live like this.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Well, it makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. If everybody's fabulously wealthy and have no cares in the world, maybe that's a possibility.
He wasn't...
I doubt it.
Taking into account all those angry poor people.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
But this is nonsense to me. As I'm sure the people who threw him in jail probably thought, too.
Maybe we can get something out of one of those quotes.
All right. I'll try. Listen, it's your show. I'm just
You don't have to agree with the philosophy.
I'm just a player on your show. All right. The law is an adroit... This is a quote from Kropotkin. The law is an adroit mixture of customs that are beneficial to society and could be followed even if no law existed. Does that make sense?
Not to me.
Not to me either. And others that are of advantage to a ruling minority, but harmful to the masses of men and can be enforced on them only by terror. No, not in a functioning democracy. It shouldn't be. Now we see the extremes of rule of law happening in Missouri at the moment. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about everyday life where you see the police car and they're there to protect and serve, mm-hmm. as it's supposed to be.
Well, what's happening in Missouri is a good example of another system being perverted, right?
Yes, so. Exactly right. Fanaticism in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we militarizing the police who are there to protect and serve, kill us?
I guess his philosophy, Peter Kropotkin's philosophy, could be valid when you apply it to that situation. You say, well, once you give the
power over... Away, he would do away with all police enforcement. That's not what people want, is it?
So how do you find the happy medium? How do you find the...
Cut the extremes. Most rational, sane people would say, we don't want either extreme. We don't want no police. That's not what people want. I don't think any sane person would say we want no police, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we do need to be protected from the people who don't adhere to the do unto others philosophy,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
I want that protection, don't you?
I do.
It would be very nice if there was no need for police. But unfortunately, in the real world, Mr. Kropotkin, there is a need. There's a need for some system of laws to live by. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Would he do away with the golden rule too? Do unto others? That's a rule.
I can't answer for him.
Yeah. But a true anarchist would say, you don't have to do unto you. Do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to live in that world. There's crazy people out there, like Kropotkin.
Yeah.
You want to hear more?
Yeah, I think
there's two more quotes.
Let's do them both.
All right. The millions of laws appear upon investigation to be divided into three principal categories: protection of property, protection of persons, protection of government. And by analyzing each of these three categories, we arrive at the same logical and necessary conclusion: the uselessness and hurtfulness of law. This guy is nuts, because there's no way anybody thinks that there. If you have a car, that you don't want a law on the books that says you can't steal my car. There's nobody who thinks protection of people is a bad thing, right?
Yeah,
and how can this guy
except
say
the guy who's trying to hurt the people?
Conclusion yeah. is uselessness and hurtfulness of that law. That is insane, Kropotkin. You need to lie down and think about this. Last quote, and then I want no more Kropotkin in my life. In existing states, a fresh law is looked upon as a remedy for evil. Instead of themselves altering what is bad, people begin by demanding a law to alter it. A law to put a stop to all the vices and all the evils which result from human indolence and cowardice.
I didn't get that one.
I'm not reading it again. I don't want to get it. I've had enough of this guy. I'm sorry to insult the millions of Kropotkinists out there. But I don't get it. I don't like it. I don't want it. I like the idea of America. Okay? Now, in practice, that's something else, right? I like the idea of my cell phone, but it doesn't always work in practice, right?
Right.
But the idea of talking to anybody in the world from my little black rectangle here and getting the whole internet and being able to Skype with somebody, these are all great ideas in theory. They don't always work.
Yeah.
But I love the idea so much so that I buy a new one every year. This I'm not buying, Mr. Kropotkin.
Not a Kropotkin fan.
No, but you know what? It's good to hear the different views so you know what you do believe.
Yeah.
Right? And who you want to be.
I think absolutely. I think sometimes you learn more from the stuff you disagree with.
Yeah, this I just can't. I mean, this is, you know, if we were all fairies, maybe. And I mean fairies as like magical little Tinkerbells, not anything derogatory.
How different is his philosophy from John Lennon's in Imagine? It's the only difference is the word imagine. Right? I think he's almost saying the same thing.
Well, I don't believe that Kropotkin is an idealist the way John Lennon was.
It seems
John Lennon wanted to stop war. Right.
Well, I think at the end, his end goal here is also stop war. He's just getting to it with a little bit more violence in the middle.
I think John Lennon would think this guy's nuts. He was speaking as an artist and an idealist. I don't have the words of the song Imagine in front of me, but I do remember quite a few. Imagine there's no countries. Imagine that's the one that sticks out to me. And that actually makes sense. It doesn't call for anarchy necessarily.
The no countries one?
Yeah. It's like the what if we were one people living for today, living life in peace? That's all he wanted.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I think you got to do to get rid of countries is get rid of government. You're not going to be able to get rid of countries and keep your government.
Why not?
Why not?
Why couldn't we still have a... Why couldn't it be a one-world government? Speaking ideally... Well,
now it's one government governing the entire world.
What if there was
one... But not
one,
separate governments for different places.
Well, no, just like...
We'd all have to get on board with one philosophy, in other words.
I think the spirit of what Lenin is saying is, what if we treated each other as if there were no countries? What if we all did unto others the way we would like to be done unto? He wanted to end war.
Mm-hmm.
And his philosophy is something I can get behind, but this I can't.
The distinction being the madness in between the part where everybody shoots each other until what's left is peace.
I don't believe that John Lennon was an anarchist or calling for anarchy. I don't believe it. Not somebody I would love to hear from your listeners that he, in fact, was, and he was a Kropotkinist. Nothing would tickle me more to hear that now.
Is Raymond still on the air in Russia?
Yeah.
And they're coming up with, I guess, new episodes, or are they...
Hundreds.
So it's not just the same episodes that you guys wrote?
No, now they've moved beyond it, because what they do is they show them Monday to Friday every night, new episode.
Wow.
So they burn through 9 years of our show in a year and a half, and then they have to write their own.
Do you see the storylines that they come up with?
I hear about them sometimes, because there's an American who worked on our show, Jeremy Stevens, who goes over there and helps them write.
And are there any of them that you've been impressed by that you've
seen? Yeah. Now, to be fair, they're doing it on a very rushed schedule, and they're not for me or us Americans. It's for them, which is how it should be. I wanted, if they were going to adapt our show, I wanted the show to be relatable to them. For them to have Russian stories and mm-hmm. family stories that they related to. I don't care that they... I don't want... they. How could they be the American stories, right?
Right.
Other than the basic tenets of humanity that we all share, sibling rivalry... your wife is always right and you're a lazy slob. That, mm-hmm. This is things that I think cross culture. But beyond that, they should have their own family, personal stories of their own rituals and their own dinners and their own habits that come into play in their daily life. That makes it more real for them.
Sure, yeah. Have you thought about bringing the show to other countries?
We have. Israel, Egypt, England, India is next.
India.
Poland.
So do you go there every time?
No. I told Sony I would go to the countries that I would like to eat in. Then I'll help you.
Well, listen, thank you so much for doing this.
It's
I'm sorry that.
My pleasure.
I'm sorry that. You're not a Kropotkin fan.
Listen,
but,
you must not. What you've done this for how long now? This show?
A year.
A year, and does everyone love their philosopher?
Surprisingly, 90% of the people love their philosopher.
I can't tell you how much I love being the guy who didn't like the philosopher or didn't agree with him.
You're very much in the minority.
Great, I live my life in the minority. I'm fine with that.
I can tell you that almost every time I do this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, usually it's with stand-up comics.
You make your next guy. I would try Kropotkin again with the next guy and see if somebody likes him.
I might bring him back at some point.
I think
point.
You should.
Yeah. There's so many to go through that I haven't gotten to the point where I want to come back to them yet.
Yeah, I know, but see that this, once you get a negative reaction, I think it's interesting to try to get a positive one because I would love to hear the episode where the guy convinces me that Kropotkin is right.
Okay.
I don't know everything or anything for that matter. This is my gut reaction to this one or two or three pages that you gave me on Kropotkin. It's the first time I'm no expert. In Kropotkin?
Well, we'll have to get somebody who wants to debate the Kropotkin theory.
I do know that I now have a new name for someone that I don't care for very much.
Kropotkin. It's got a good ring to it, I think, you know?
Yeah, it's got two Ks, which is doubly funny. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, well, I probably won't leave this in the interview, but I had one more question.
Leave it in.
Robert, the character of Robert.
Yeah.
You mentioned it in the book, and I remember it, of course, from the show.
Yeah.
Always giving him something and taking something away.
Yes.
At the end when he gets the house, and then, you know, his parents move back in with
him. Sure, we just thought this was a funny thing to do to him.
Well, is he based?
He's me.
That's what I thought. I thought Robert was you. That's what I wanted to get to.
The point of view.
Yeah.
I had a brother 5 years younger than me who was much cuter, and everyone loved him for good reason more than me. And I was a jealous little kid, and I totally identified with the Robert character as Ray described him to me from his real life and his real brother, who actually said the words after seeing an award that Ray won. Never ends for Raymond. Everybody loves Raymond. Right? And so I just hooked into that. I identified with it. I said, that's me. That was me growing up.
It's funny that the show, because the show is named from the perspective of Robert.
The brother. Yeah. Yeah. But I loved how specific it was, that it was from a specific point of view, because I believe that in these specifics comes a universality. We all feel a specific way about something, especially our families, right? And so that's what made it for me. That's what, and my wife saw it in the script. I didn't have a title on the show. She saw that I had the brother, as Ray's brother actually said, say that in the pilot. She said, that should be the name of the show. I said, I can't think of a better one.
Yeah. Well, I love it. And thank you again so much for taking the time to do this.
It's my absolute pleasure.
Well, it's my absolute pleasure.
Take care.
You too. Goodbye.
Bye.
Well, there you go, everybody. There's our show. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you to my guest, Phil Rosenthal. Thank you to Kylie for saying yes to me. And and if you want to make a donation towards the wedding fund, I wouldn't object. I'd appreciate it. Of course, there's no pressure to do so, but any donation is good because that's how we support the show here. You know, keeps this going, keeps me going. It's like PBS or NPR, any of those things. I've always tried to make that analogy. You know, it's you sponsor the show. Sponsor the show. Please? Can you sponsor the show? ModernDayPhilosophers.net. TheComicalYahoo.com. If you want to write me and say hello, I would love to hear from you. Please send me an email. And as always, I beg you to go on iTunes and leave 5 stars and a nice comment, because it helps the show's visibility on iTunes, and hopefully more people see it, more people click it, more people hear it, more people like it, more people share it, and it grows and it continues. All right, everybody, that's it for today. First show of 2015. Have a great week. I hope you're all doing fantastic. I hope things are going well for you, and I can't wait to talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.